Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Education Committee to order. It is Wednesday, January 28th, 2026, and the time is 8:02 a.m. Members present are Representative Dibert, Representative Schwanke, Representative Eichscheid, Representative Underwood, Co-Chair Story, and myself, Co-Chair Himshute. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind everyone in the room to please silence your cell phones. Makes for a much better meeting. And we are in the Betty Davis Committee Room 106 in the State Capitol Building here in Juneau, Alaska. The documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members and are available on the table outside the door and on BASIS. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Kale Brown, and our moderator from the Juneau LIO, Zach Lawhorn, for being here this morning, and of course our committee aides, Ella Lubin and Tammy Smith, make it all work. So thank you to them. We have one agenda item scheduled for today's House Education Committee meeting. It's an update from the State Tribal Education Compacting Demonstration Schools. There will be one slide deck, and members have copies, have a copy of the slide deck. I would like to welcome our presenters, Misha Jackson with Tribal Education Liaison for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, Mark Roseberry from the education, he's the education director at and school administrator at the ICAS Argy Academy, Sonia Skan, Education and Training Director, Ketchikan Indian Community, Carl Shambly, Executive Director, Knik Tribe, and Kiminuk Maddie Akviak Elvana Stimful. Can't wait to hear that pronounced the right way. Curator of Educational Programs at Katurvik Cultural Center, and Dr. Joel Isaac, Compacting Contractor with the Department of Education and Early Development. I know you guys were talking about how you were going to three at a time or however you wanted to do this, but when you come forward, if you would introduce yourself for the record so we can keep track of who was talking when, and then begin your presentation, the floor is yours. We're glad you're here.
Good morning. For the record, Misha Jackson, Chukungi Kla. I work for Tlingit and Haida as the Tribal Education Liaison. Sheesh for having us here. So through the chair, thank you guys for starting us off, kicking us off in the second week, and it's good to see you guys all again. Nice to see new faces. Happy to be here and share this today. We essentially call ourselves the STEC Tribal Partners. This is the family that we've become. STEC is the State Tribal Education Compacting Tribal Partners from Tlingit and Haida, Knik, ICAS, Ketchikan Indian Community, the Village of Solomon, and King Island. Right, I got all five of them off the top of my head, so thank you. And just for perspective, we recognize Joel is here to assist. He contracts with DEED. He provides a lot of the technical details. That's not to say we don't know them. We just make sure he rises to the occasion and share those when called upon. So this is Tribal Partners' presentation. This is from the perspective of the tribes about this bill, something that we've been very passionate about for the past couple of years and probably the past 10 plus years, as many of us will express. So we wanted to start off with really trying to ground the conversation in what success looks like in education when it's operated by tribes. We put a lot of images in here, hopefully, so that you guys can see this is more than just a bill in front of you. These are our children. These are our future generations. These are the future of Alaska, really, is what we're talking about, trying to have an impact and an influence and a seat at the table for. There's a very great video from Cook Inlet Tribal Council as part of this process about education. That's the dialogue that's been going on since 2016. There have been a lot of statewide partners and regional partners as part of that process trying to bring this vision and this story to life. And so they have a great video there. It's about 13 minutes long. We're kind of going to just enlighten you of it if you haven't seen it yet, but we do know, recognize a few of you seen it, and we'll make sure that link gets shared and possibly shared at another presentation in the future. But really what that video is is guided to show is just the historical context of what this experience has been like for Alaska Natives in particular, since, again, this is a tribal perspective of education. And it really speaks to the strength-based approach that tribes take to education and what education could be, what education is right now when we are at the table and we play a partnership role, and what we know that our communities want to hear, want to see, want to feel in school for their children. And that's what's possible, is we really want to get people to start thinking not from a threat, not from a protective, but really what happens when you open the door to another partner in education, and a partner that historically, through that video, you will see all of the different bills that have happened and things and historical events that tribes have been pushed so far off to the side in education that this is just trying to get you to reframe how we're looking at education from a different perspective, right, and a different possibility. So
I'm going to jump in for just a second and mention a couple of things. At 8:05, we were joined by Representative Elam. Glad you're here. And also, to be really clear, this is a presentation today. There isn't a bill in front of the committee.
So correct.
It would change how we do some things. So thank you.
Thank you. So to give a general overview from a tribal perspective of what is compacting, is it's a contractual agreement between two or more sovereign governments. And so the way we have found the easiest way to describe this to a lot of educators when we've presented and talked with folks at Alaska Association of School Boards presentations is sovereign governments are the ones that are allowed to issue you a passport or an ID that can get you across state lines, country lines. So that's federal, state, and tribes. Okay. So that's probably the most important thing for us to get folks to understand is there are three sovereign governments, and you will find over different laws and cases that it has been found that there is a trilateral responsibility of those three entities to ensure the education of citizens, right? And so for us, that's our tribal citizens, but it also means that we can also play a role, and we want to play a role in public school education. That's our avenue here in Alaska, and our avenue and our mechanism to get there is through compacting, through these agreements. And so through compacting, the state and tribes choose to participate in requirements of the compact that honors the interests of both parties. And so this was a process we went through. We started in our negotiations for about 8 straight months, really looking at what would a compact agreement look like and what would those provisions be of how we would operate schools in Alaska through a pilot project, and what are the different elements of requirements, basically state providing funding, what are the expectations for the state, what are the expectations for the tribes. And so that was very lengthy discussions. We were able to build off of the Washington State example, and they have a compact agreement with 7 different tribes. They have 7 different compact agreements, and you will find little nuances that are different in each of them depending on their case, but those have been, I think, in existence for close to 10 years now at this point. So tribes have long-term experience with compacting. So this is something new to the state for education. It already exists for healthcare and I call it child support services, but I guess it would be OCS. Tribes are leading the way as to how to conduct negotiations in these processes and to be in partnership. And so I can't emphasize those words more. I think a lot lands on the process of negotiations is what we call them, but really they were in partnership conversations facilitated between Department of Education staff and all of our tribal teams, which were filled with lawyers, passionate educators, elders, teachers, all the folks behind me as well. So it was a very empowering process that we are really looking at how the tribes can finally be a partner in education in the state of Alaska. So how this bill came to be, I added a couple bullet points in here because it felt like, since we're in front of House Education Committee, I appreciate all the insight you guys have, the years you have with these conversations and presentations in front of you. I do recognize that probably this first one is a class in itself at a graduate level, but I put in there federal school policy, starting from boarding schools and to BIA. And in essence, what I'm referring to is once Alaska became a territory and boarding schools and mission schools, and then eventually once the federal government came in with the BIA, they were often seen as day schools, that those all are an interruption to traditional educational systems. And so we did not have a, and I say we in the sense that we as tribes did not have a seat at the table, right? And back then we weren't even quote unquote federally recognized tribes, but we had our own governance structures. We had our own education systems. We have our own knowledge systems. And so when this idea and concept and construct of education as a system came through, tribes were not at the table for those conversations. Once all of BIA comes through and federally recognized tribes are acknowledged, are created essentially. Again, tribes are not at the table for those conversations. Statehood comes to be in about the 1950s, even though the statehood conversations date back to 1916, technically. Again, tribes as entities are not in those conversations. The Constitutional Convention, I believe we had one representative from Southeast, but we had allies at that space. But if you look at voice and the voice of tribes in the designing of the system of education in Alaska, tribes have not been at the table. And it's hard to really see where that voice has come through. And so as we continued on with the one system of education statewide, once the Constitution is passed, then Joel does a much better job of describing this, but in essence, the Bureau of Indian Affairs decides they are going to pull out of Alaska, right? This dual system that exists because the Constitution only wants to recognize one system of education. And so the BIA and their federal trust responsibilities, they pull out and are basically, you know, it's assigned to the state, these responsibilities. During that process, again, tribes are not at the table. And so you can look at those news articles that BIA even puts out that these were statewide federal conversations, but you will also see that tribes are requesting that this not happen because those BIA schools were the avenue to self-determination in education. And so once the BIA pulled out of those, then tribes were not able to access what's called ISD EAA, which is the Indian Self-Determination in Education Act. And so we aren't able to then start triggering our role in self-determination. And that's what's different down in the lower 48, is those schools, they have BIA schools, which then they are able to start taking over as tribally controlled public schools or tribally controlled schools. And so that avenue exists in lower 48, but it doesn't exist up here. And so up here in the state, they eventually, you know, it goes from one statewide system and then they decentralize it. They create the Rural Education Agency area, the REAA system. And I think what's really interesting to note of that is it does exist, it still is part of our system, but tribes are not a part of that policy, right? And I don't know if it was inherent or assumed, I wasn't here during those times, but you're looking at rural education and tribes are not partners in the creation of that system and the maintenance of the system. I'm not saying anything against it, but I'm just trying to get you to reframe where have tribes been in these conversations, right? And so they do have representation. They have I believe they're not called school boards, but essentially they operate as school boards elected through that process. And they're representatives of the community. But again, like, where is that tribal voice, that sovereign tribal voice for self-determination in education, especially over these communities and the community of education? So that went way longer than I expected to kind of paint that picture. But then if you kind of think about these things and all the education policy that's come since then, like, where are tribes in these conversations, right? And I think inherently what's starting to happen is nobody is necessarily at fault, but it does start to feel like there is not trust that tribes understand education enough to be at the table is kind of where it's coming from. So my case in point is, you know, after the Alaska cultural standards are passed and there's initiatives to make sure language and culture get inside of the schools, the creation of the Type M limited teaching certificate comes to be, which is a fantastic process of making sure we have language teachers, but it comes with barriers. And as states, as, you know, and essentially in a leader in Indigenous education at one point in time, there are almost about 20 states that have something similar, a language and a cultural teaching certificate in their state. The state of Alaska is the only one that doesn't incorporate tribes. So all other states that have this certificate require them to go through the tribes to determine whether or not they are proficient in language to provide this certification. And the state of Alaska is the only one that doesn't have tribes as part of that policy. So that's kind of my example of like, okay, so where are we going with this? And then why are tribes really wanting to be at the table now for these initiatives? So
I'm going to ask to pause for just a second. It's been a lot of information. So is it okay as we go through this to stop every now and then and take questions?
Absolutely, because I can keep going. So my apologies.
I know Elam had a question.
Thank you, and I definitely don't mean to break your train of thought. I appreciate where you're going with that. I know that particularly with the Alaska Native tribes and throughout the communities, the language thing is a big, big issue. I hear about it regularly. What kind of demand are you seeing with our families, with our parents, you know, and what kind of involvement, you know, are you looking at from your communities outside of just the traditional educators and folks that, you know, but yes, thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Elam, apologies if I said that wrong. That is probably one of the most beautiful, poignant questions. That is why I sit at this table. So to speak personally, my husband is an intermediate language speaker. Both of our family lines, the passage of the language was interrupted. And so it has been a passion to find different ways to ensure we can get language inside of the school. And so I'm thankful. My husband now teaches for us in the Juneau community in the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy program, where he's able to do that. But they also have elders that come into the classroom. They are not Type M certified. You know, it's a part of this optional program that they've created, basically. And we have seen one of the most recent grandmas that come through there. She was a dormant speaker. And then just putting her in that place, and she shares space inside of my husband's classroom, probably one of the best teacher aides I've ever seen in my lifetime. I mean, yeah, I recommend you go watch her in action. But through that process, that the language is coming alive again in her. And she is a phenomenal speaker with deep, deep knowledge that just needed to be in that space, right? And so she comes with her own experiences. And I think that replicates a lot of our elder generation of they have it in them, but they haven't been provided the space or the confidence and knowledge to be in those spaces. And so you see that trickle down, and we have a very large population. In Juneau, we make up about 30% of the student body population. And so when we host events, there is a strong demand for culture and language in there. And so when we do surveys about budget cuts and everything else, our parents are demanding that our language is protected. And so as a tribe, what we're doing on the parallel side is we've created an immersion nest where we have second birth speakers? Second language learners. Who are running classrooms fully in Tlingit for a small group of students and graduating students out of there. And our families want more of those opportunities. TCLL has a wait list. Our immersionist has a wait list. The demand is high. The adult speakers is growing slowly but surely, and so we need to be creative with how to get them into the classroom and simultaneously teach them while they teach children. And so it's really complicated for us, just mostly because we're in Southeast. I think I hope the folks behind me that are doing a lot of the work as well can kind of explain how language impacts and the demand for that as well. So I hope I answered your question correctly.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Okay.
And Representative Dybert?
Yes, through the co-chair. Thank you. Ms. Jackson, for your presentation. I just wanted to comment and then to follow up with Elam's question. I think it's really important to go over this history. We might have new people on Gavel to Gavel who are watching this, and it's important to hear kind of the history of where we are today with language, tribal topics, and getting elders in classroom. So just, I love it. Keep going. And then to follow up with Representative Elam, from what I understand, there might be like a clearinghouse of curriculum that could be available to educators where teachers can access curriculum that might have some language in that area. So I'm not sure, but that might be the goal. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions? I had one question. In the REAAs, what is it, rural education attendance areas? Regional education attendance areas, I think, yeah. In those areas, I think that the type M is not just in those areas, and the type M is locally requested. So just to be clear, if you're in the REAA, if you're in an REAA and you want a local person to get a type M, that's a like a local decision. So in that case, there could be very strong tribal voice. So I'm not saying that it's okay not to require that, but not every type M is about language either. So I guess that I think there was an assumption maybe made with the when that type M was added that it would be locally determined and that would include tribes, but it doesn't necessarily explicitly say that. So
yeah. Through the chair, thank you for that clarification. It teacher prep in Alaska is pretty complex as we are and is still adapting as we go. And so the point I was trying to make with the type M that is used specifically for language and culture is the requirement is only that the school district verify that this person qualifies to teach this language, and oftentimes they ask for a letter of support or a resume, and then the school district then sends that to DEED as verification, and then DEED is, you know, goes through their process to provide that. And so the point I was trying to make is that we are the only state that doesn't explicitly include tribes as part of that process. So these are superintendents, administrators, maybe a teacher who are making this recommendation, you know, that goes up the chain and basically kind of circles around a tribe as a sovereign government who, you know, inherently has rights and knowledge and expertise of their language and culture.
Okay. Thank you for that. Oh, Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Quick question on that. I know in the Copper River we have some new Type M educators that are coming in through OTNA with some of the cultural certifications that they're receiving out of the University of Alaska. And I believe our Indian Education Committee is integral in vetting and communicating. And, of course, small communities, everybody knows everybody. Can you describe how your Indian Education Committee down here interacts in this space?
Yes, through the chair. I think this is a great example of the different elements of local control. So here in Juneau, we don't have requests that come to us or interactions or partnerships with our Title VI Indian Education Office or those folks about those situations, I guess.
Quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Do you have an Indian Education Committee associated with Juneau Douglas School District?
Through the chair, yes. So we have what's called Title VI Indian Studies Program. It's been around since probably the 70s, I want to say. It's a very strong program. It works primarily in the elementary schools, but all the way up to the high schools, and we have different what are called cultural paraeducators as part of that process. Those cultural paraeducators exist as staff primarily as under that classified paraeducator kind of a lens. They are not necessarily Type M certified to be in those positions.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I just did a little check here. We have 41 slides. We have about an hour and a half to go. I want to ask you to guide us here because people are in town. I think we'll be able to – you're here all the time.
Yes.
We can get you. Yeah. And Dr. Isaac, you would come back if we needed. But our other partners might have a harder time getting here. So you tell me how you want this to go. Should we –
Yeah, we just have a couple more slides that kind of set the tone for the bill, and then we're going to go into the examples.
Okay.
And I try to make my Clink and Hide example really fast because I hope you.
Right. Yeah. And we can get you back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. And I appreciate all the conversations. So so through the chair, on bullet point two, I added one about statewide efforts because, again, as Representative Dibert mentioned, it's really important to share this level of history. Back in the late 90s, there was the Alaska Rural Systemic Initiative that was funded by a National Science Foundation grant in collaboration with the Alaska Federation of Natives. And it was a statewide effort that broke all of the state into regions, but also created statewide newsletters called Sharing Our Pathways. Lots of instrumental folks that played a role in that. A lot of our elders were at those tables having those conversations, creating their organized group in the different regions, building the curriculum that is still housed online to this very day that's available. And so what I try and relate this to is essentially this is what we're trying to replicate again, is statewide efforts for Alaska Native education and that idea of creating this space for curriculum, for models, for strategies, for MOAs, for partnership ideas that can really innovate the state of Alaska and share knowledge because we are spread so thin that it really we do need a statewide driving force. And we had presented at the Tribal Affairs about this Alaska Native Tribal Education Consortium, but we really need a statewide driving force focused on Alaska Native education to really push out what has already been done and what can be done. And so that Alaska Rural Systemic Initiative was actually the brainchild behind the Alaska Cultural Standards that got passed very, very quickly through the state processes, which I think a lot of people back in those days were pretty shocked and also very proud of. But with that is also an ideal conception that may not always in practice be ideal, right? And so we refer to these. I hear folks refer to Alaska cultural standards very frequently, but what that looks like in practice for teacher evaluations, curriculum review processes, right? It's not at the center of those processes, and those are really rich. They are about schools, they're about families, they're about teachers, they're about administrators, and they cover all of the different elements there. And so one thing that I know we had a lot of conversations is that we stand on the shoulders of those giants. And for us as tribes, centering those Alaska cultural standards in the design of a system, in a design of an operation of a school, is to us what we see as the difference maker, right? It's not an additive. It's not this outside element that we can pick up and put down when we choose, just like our cultural identities, our tribal citizenship, our identity. It's with us every day. And so being able to center the work of those folks from the late 90s is really what excites us more than anything else when we're looking at the operations of a school. So in terms of the bill itself, we had the Alaska Education Challenge 2016, which picked up these conversations that were starting in the 80s about compacting in education. It was one of the primary goals of Alaska education, and then it led to the passage of SB 34 in 2022. And I think Deed can go into a lot more details and nuances about this process, but the tribes were very much at the table throughout this process. The five tribes applied. Over the course of 3 months, there was a window of opportunity, and five tribes, I like to say we rose to the occasion, because this is, it's exciting, but it's scary, and it's a lot of work to undertake, and so we went through the process of successful negotiations is the best way I can describe it. And the outcomes were a 70-page legislative report that we all had pen and paper on. This, you know, Deed was at the table, but tribes were definitely the driving force behind the language, what was in there, what are the findings, what we think is needed as a statewide system to make this successful. And so that report then was presented in 2024, I want to say by February of that time. So some key highlights from those negotiations, and I've been able to touch on some of these throughout the time, but they're just bullets to kind of keep in your brain as we're reframing what tribal education, our lens is for us, first and foremost, it always came down to innovation and collaboration. Every day at that table and in those conversations, we are talking about education, innovation, things that we know we're capable of doing when we center what we know is for us and the definition of success. And through the Alaska cultural standards, through self-determination and language and culture, when you mix all of those together, that's the root of that innovation.
Oh, sorry, Representative Elam.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt again. You're just hitting on a lot of things that I'm really appreciative of. So thank you for the conversation. I'm curious from like a governing perspective, you know, how the tribes would work with some of this. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you're describing is like language immersion, which we have some charter schools up in the throughout the state that do that. On the peninsula, we have a couple of different charter schools that do other programs that are the Kenai Peninsula. That's where I'm from. that do very immersive type education programs and stuff. And so how would you guys be governing some of this? Whenever I was looking through the proposed bill, it seems to have actually a fair amount of structure behind it and how you guys would be working for governing intertribally. And I'm just kind of wondering how that works with some of these sort of family and tribal connections.
I'll let a new voice enter.
Okay. Joel Isaac, for the record, through the chair to Representative Elam. It's good to see you this morning.
Good morning.
It's also my school district that I went through. So the piece around school governance is one of the main three pillars of the bill and the legislative report. And the process that's outlined is that each tribally compacted public school, as a public school, the tribe would set up its own governing body. The structure of the bill is that the tribe functions as a school district, so it would have its governing body like a current school district has a local school board, and the tribe would set up that local school board for that school. So it's not mandating that the tribes have the same one for all five schools. Each tribe has their own governance of that school because each tribe has its own unique cultural language, and it's also its own government. And so that's, I think, in a nutshell, that governance piece, and that's one of the critical foundations of the innovation and the sovereignty in action is that governing body.
Follow up? I mean, there was a lot of, whenever I was reviewing the bill, there was a lot of layers of, I mean, it looked very accountable to the tribes in creating this governing body and everything. And so would you have community members participating in that? You know, how would you make sure that your language and traditions and culture would be immersed into that and still have all of that with the accountabilities? Would you create like small school boards or?
Through the chair to Representative Elam, yes, it would essentially be a small school board. And I'll do a nod to the tribes behind me. So, the process is the tribe, for example, with ICAS and with KNIC, they've established ordinances, which is tribal law, to set up an education committee. Kenai's Indian Tribe in your district mm-hmm. has an education committee set up by its council. So although Kenai's is not in their tribal partners, many tribes around the state have a school or an education committee. And for the five tribes in this case, it would be following those specific accountability frameworks that are in the bill would need to be added as duties of that committee if they want to use that same committee to meet the needs of the bill. And so the school board is meeting the accountability structures that existing school boards have to make sure, like finances, evaluations, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you. I'm all good. Thank you. I don't want to take too far off the rails.
Yeah. Okay. And just for clarification, I may be misunderstanding this, but to be a federally recognized tribe, a tribe must have a constitution and bylaws?
Through the chair, yes, there are two. You'll hear Indian IRA tribes and traditional councils as two names, but you're going through a legally binding agreement with the federal government and the tribal citizens. And that's typically, it's a constitution, is that legally binding document.
And then to be clear, that constitution, so the requirement is to have a constitution, but how that's written and what the bylaws say is tribally directed.
To the chair, Joel Isaac, for the record, yes, and depending on what era that tribe's constitution is written, many of them have a provision that requires the Secretary of the Interior mm-hmm. to certify and run the election, or the not the election, the constitutional amendments. And some tribes, when they wrote their constitution, did not include the Department of the Interior. Some have then had votes to remove the Secretary of the Interior as the one who runs that constitutional convention, essentially. But that's kind of the nuances that might come up in that, like, why is the Secretary or the BI or the Department of the Interior involved? It's because there were template constitutions that were basically shopped around to the tribes, and then the tribes adopted that, and then some were later, and they didn't include that language.
Right. Okay. Ready? All right, let's keep going.
All right. Through the chair, Isaac, I let Joel answer that one because I could spend a lot of time on that one as well. It's an exciting part for us as a tribe as we're starting to develop our education code, and the process for that has been really fun and very community-driven. So happy to speak more on that in person. So, I would just wrap up with these ones. I think the teacher recruitment and retention, it was a key part of negotiations, and essentially what we as tribes, again, from this is a tribal perspective, was a deal breaker for us. If that was not a part of the process, that we could have essentially control in partnership with DEED about what teacher recruitment, retention, and most importantly, certification looked like and training, then this was not going to work and was not going to be something we would recommend to the state to do. Being able to train teachers, and I have wonderful folks in back that can speak really in depth about this, is absolutely what helps define what we can do and includes all of these elements of family and community engagement. So imagine our teacher prep programs now, where that was the center of your teacher preparation, was knowing how to pick up the phone and call a parent and how to communicate across cultures. That isn't necessarily something that's emphasized right now, right? And so that's the lens we're looking at, is we know what works for our communities. We also, unfortunately, know what hasn't worked for our communities, and being able to bring that forward in how we train our teachers and prepare our teachers so our teachers can be successful, our teachers can feel supported, and our teachers want to stay. And that's truly what we feel is a goal of this program, and I think is going to be the innovative part that has the chance to really change what education looks like in Alaska. So, high-level overview of the bill. Please remember, this is a tribal perspective. I have Joel here for those finite questions. Essentially, what HB 59 SB 66 is designed to do is establish a process for government-to-government agreements between the state of Alaska and tribes to operate public schools. It is designed as a standalone pilot project, so building off of the demonstration project that we essentially finished and put the report together. This is a pilot project built off of that demonstration. It's uncodified and it's limited in scope. It is designed to essentially be like research, designed to test, revise, and evaluate. Because if this is something the state wants to see, more tribes want to be a part of, this is an opportunity for five tribes to test and revise and evaluate as we go, essentially, and really being a part of that community research process. It appropriates funds in the same manner as an REAA, and as the bill is written, the tribal compact schools must be in effect and in operation by June 30th, 2028, is what's written into the bill. Inside of that bill, it also refers to the creation of compact agreement for education services between each tribe and the state of Alaska, and this is where the state agrees to provide and do X, Y, and Z, and then the tribe agrees to do X, Y, and Z as part of those services. It also includes a lot of legal information that our team of probably 10 different lawyers came through and helped us define and negotiate through that process. Some highlights from that is it does maintain statewide standards and accountability. It creates a limited tribal teacher certification opportunity, and in essence what it does is it outlines the provisions for tribal operations, and for us it's also looking at the opportunity for shared services with local school districts as well as across the tribally compacted schools if that's something that tribes want to opt into.
I have a question. Any other questions on this slide? My question is, what is driving the June 30th, 2028 date?
To the chair, Joel Isaac, for the record, in negotiations, we talked about the need for a school to ramp up, and there's the question mark of when in session might a bill pass, and then the processes for a bill to become a law. And so it gives the tribes two years to set up a school. The pilot needs to be probably the other things is we want to see results from the pilot, the legislature, the department. And so the 2 years is a typical process from talking with the tribes and then also looking at the federal government has funded tribal programs that start up charter schools. And so modeling off of like how long does it take a tribe to start a school if they don't have one, it's a 2 to 3 year window. And so that's where it landed on the 2 year window. And then there's 5 years for the school to operate. And that's why it's by 2028. So the tribe has up to 2 years to open its doors.
And so I am still confused about demonstration pilot project. Here's how I have it sorted in my head. Please correct me. We are in a demonstration period for the 5 tribes who were selected. And the bill that we keep referring to, even though this is a presentation, sets up a pilot project.
To the chair, that is correct. Senate Bill 34, as was mentioned on a previous slide, that was a demonstration. And if you think about proof of concept, to send to the legislature and then to make that proof of concept a reality, that's where a bill is needed to create the pilot to test, revise, and evaluate how efficacious those schools are.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So as part of the processes and hopefully through the context as we're starting to move towards the different tribes in the examples, the language we landed on that we feel was really important moving forward was we would like these to be considered tribally compacted public schools to help with this narrative and understanding of the context that we've provided, the negotiations and et cetera, is making sure tribes are in that name compacted so that we can elevate sovereignty and understanding what level of a government-to-government agreement this is, and then public schools. So I know this entire time I speak from a tribal perspective. I am a tribal citizen. This is my life through and through for I don't know how long. But I am a public educator at heart. I am a graduate of all public schools and universities across the country. I have never been to a private school in my entire life. I only know public education. So I hope that as people make the assumption I'm only talking about tribes and teaching tribes. For me, the assumptions are I'm talking about all public schools, all students. This is open to all students. We will meet the same standards as the current public schools that are open to all students. So I want to make sure I kind of put this slide here so that you understand, like, this is my perspective, but what may not come forward is that I am speaking to all students in Alaska. And so tribally compacted public schools for us is local control of public education that centers tribes and communities. Essentially, that's our easiest definition moving forward. So why this matters to education in Alaska, this is where we get to bring up all of our experts standing with us in the 5 tribal partners. This is from our perspective of why this matters in Alaska. So since I'm here, I again am the tribal education liaison for Tlingit and Haida. I came to Tlingit and Haida happily after many years in public education at the university, at the local school district, working for JOM staff, contracting, playing a supplemental role, summer camps, you name it, graduate education over and over again, probably more courses than I can imagine, but this is the happiest place I was meant to be. I am here because of this opportunity. I work with Clinkett and Haida in what's called an education development department, which was created, and it's designed to move Clinkett and Haida through different partnerships and expanding into education programming. But what's really important for us to make sure folks know is that Clinkett and Haida already operates education programs. They just might not fit the everyday definition of what education is, and then that's what we're trying to get folks to reframe. So we this is our tribal assembly. That is our governing body. All of those wonderful faces on that photo. This was from the 89th annual tribal assembly, where President Peterson did make the announcement that we were going to be working towards the creation of an education campus here in Juneau. So our mission is to preserve our sovereignty, enhance our economic and cultural resources, and promote self-sufficiency and self-governance for our systems. And we believe that is possible through education. So we have right now, this is a growing slide for those of you guys that have seen this slide before. I got to add two more people. I hope to add plenty more. These are just a few of our education, tribal education expertise. You are looking at 7 Alaska certified teachers that currently work for the tribe. A lot of master's degrees, a lot of graduate work up there. It was really designed, unfortunately, what I do hear or don't hear and read between the lines is that tribes aren't capable of doing this. And so I put this slide up front to show you we are more than capable, not just as tribal citizens, not just as indigenous peoples, but we also have the Western frameworks and knowledge as well. So we want to be equal partners. We have a lot of expertise. And part of what Representative Elam was referring to is we actually have a grant right now where it's a tribal education department grant, and we are currently in the process of designing our education code and implementing, looking at how our tribal values are going to influence our all of our education programming. And we have probably about 25 people just in-house at Clinkett and Haida that come to the table for those conversations that have education expertise, and then we're going to expand that through community conversations as well. In terms of the education programming we provide, I just am here highlighting our early education. We are a primary operator in Southeast Alaska of Head Start. And so we are in 10 Southeast communities and have upwards of 15 Head Start classrooms that educate 190 young children and their parents every day. That is actually growing and expanding as we continue to develop partnerships and build out. Prince of Wales will have a new campus that we work a lot with in the childcare realm as well. And so we're expanding to make sure that those two things are complementary at the same time. Wrangell is another place you'll see some expansion probably happening in the near future as well. And then, as I mentioned, Prince of Wales, we're expanding language immersion, childcare, and Head Start basically all at the same time in Prince of Wales, Craig, and Klawak in those two places. So we offer education programming. We have family home visiting programs. We have fatherhood, motherhood is sacred programs. We have community behavioral services, which is another space for really important education with folks, sometimes on group levels, one-on-one levels. We also have vocational programming. Young adults, Generation Southeast operates on Juneau and on Prince of Wales, doing a lot of hands-on learning carpentry. We, you know, it's always growing, and our goal is to be cradle to career. It is the K-12 section is probably the biggest chunk and probably the most influential chunk of time that we are missing. We do provide services and support services for students in those age groups and for families, but we do not operate a K-12 school at this time. What I can also brag about is we run the Hayukhatungi Kuri Immersion Nest Classroom, which is for ages 3 to 5 here in Juneau. We have centralized all of our early education in Juneau out at Floyd Dryden, so it's a great space to go visit as we're starting to open up classrooms there. And our Tlingit Language Immersion Nest has graduated upwards of 25, I believe, students into the Juneau School District. I don't have official research results, but as the Alaska Reads Act has built up and they're looking at developing language assessments, the Tlingit language is one of the assessments, and they've done some pilot studies at the local Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program, where a lot of the teachers are part of that development of a language assessment. And they were able to share with us that our immersionist graduates are testing higher than their peers in TCLL, and that's both at language and in English reading. And so those Dibbles tests, et cetera, it's our NEST students that are testing the highest and essentially kind of skewing the results as well. So we know this works. We now have the data to show we know that this is working. It clicks something else in your kids' brains when they go through immersion. And I think that's what's really exciting. I had one child that was able to go through the immersion NEST, and the way she can think is dramatically different than her sisters. And it's a fascinating thing to watch. So.
Just a second. Yeah. I know that Representative Story has a question. I also just want to highlight, along with building new Head Start facilities in both Craig and Kluwak, there's also a senior center going in Craig. So Tlingit Haida is just really carrying a lot of water in the Prince of Wales region.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for that. So Representative Story, Co-Chair Story had a question.
Thank you, Chair Himeshud. Basically, I didn't have a question. I had a comment and wanted to let everyone know that my daughter, Mallory Story, teaches in the Immersion NEST and is an intermediate Tlingit speaker, and my granddaughter, who is 3, is a student there, and she is learning the language as a non-native person. So,
and the research behind people who speak two languages is sometimes it can hold you back a little in elementary, and then it propels you forward mm-hmm. later. And so anybody who has the opportunity to speak two languages is getting a great opportunity. Okay, going on.
So through the chair, community and family engagement is at the heart of education for us. And so I'll touch on the sources below just to provide some context. But we are very proud at Tlingit and Haida. We have had a strong history of Indigenous educators that have played a role in education in this community across the state and across the national level as well. So William Demert he helped found the National Indian Education Association, very well respected. He is Tlingit, and we have a lot of other folks. And he helped spearhead in 1983 the Southeastern Conference on Native Education, where he brought in a lot of those educators that were trained, elders, et cetera. And the richness of the information we have from that and since is what has been guiding a lot of our education programming. And so we use stuff from there and all of the meetings we've had since. In more recent times, we hosted a Juneau community conversation during the consolidation here in Juneau and the budget cuts where they were going to close schools. In Tlingit and Haida, we hosted our own community conversation where we had over 120 community members who had not yet participated in those budget conversations come forward and have their voice heard by school board members and such. We also are, as I mentioned, working on a tribal education department project that will include community voice as well, but current expertise. And at the heart of that is always these three things that are coming through that our families want. They want us to protect and expand the teaching of Tlingit language, culture, and history. They want an emphasis on academic and social emotional supports, cultural identity, knowledge, and tribal values, and they want intergenerational learning spaces and more engagement.
I need to run. Oh, sorry. All right. Representative Elam.
I just wanted to, I need to step away for a few minutes, but I just wanted to thank you for coming out. This has been really great information. I hope we continue this conversation, and I should be back in just a little bit, but I just respectfully wanted to thank you for coming out. Yeah.
Okay. Here we go. Through the chair. Again, as we reflect on our tribal education project that we're going through, since we do not operate a K-12 school, the opportunities for us are endless for these pathways that we can create for families to guide us there. And obviously at the top is language immersion. Service-based learning is really important to us as a community and really is a way to integrate the community. Career and technical education, that is something we already offer, and being able to create that pipeline. Pre-apprenticeship, both in career and technical fields, but also for us for education, is at the heart of probably my work for the past 15 years. You won't find a student in Juneau that knows me who I haven't tried to recruit to be a teacher yet or make volunteer in my husband's husband's classroom. I've been doing this work for too long, and I'm not going to give up. College preparation, dual credit opportunities, and really looking at that lens of a pre-K to 14 is really the model we're starting to look at and what that could develop into. I'm really excited for you guys to hear from the folks behind us of what they are doing live in action that has been guiding some of our conversations as well. And then I leave just with some quotes that I have shared before and some more information. Dennis Demard is another Indigenous educator. He was Tlingit out of University of Alaska Fairbanks. And so what we're really trying to guide towards is a structural transformation in education, and that's what's grounding us in our work at Tlingit and Haida. And so I have this quote that kind of guides my own personal perspective on education, but how to make the change and the difference. And so Dennis Demard says, when Native education is bad and people get upset about it, all kinds of corrective programs are spread like nets over the educational grounds. Each program snags Natives just as we used to snag Humpies, puts them on tally sheets, and justifies its existence. Bad education, like good fishing, is good business. Everybody's busy and everybody's happy, but it's the poor fish that get caught. And so we are looking for structural change, systems change. That's why we are looking into operations of public schools, because we don't want to keep replicating what has been happening. There is a lot of success, but we truly believe that this operations focused and the delivery model focus is what can be the difference. And so Eve Tuck is an educational researcher. She has roots from the St. Paul Island. 2009, she published a very famous letter to her colleagues as education researchers called Suspending Damage. And what she is basically saying is that, you know, when we do damage-centered research that documents the pain and brokenness in ways for especially Native communities, it reinforces a one-dimensional narrative of our communities, right? That they're to be fixed. It's right. It's echoing what Dennis Demard has said. And so what she is calling for is a reimagining of research that is conducted by, for, and with communities. And this is what we believe this project is. This is the opportunity for us as a community to be a part of this education research and the difference. And so it's taking that strength-based approach. So, Gunjish.
Before we lose Ms. Jackson, I had just a couple of questions that I should have asked several slides ago. Okay. So, my questions have to do with Washington and the compacts that are happening there. Are those compacts on reservations?
Through the chair, I would have to look at their map. There are approximately 6 or 7. All of them but one are a compact with a BIE-funded school, so most likely directly tied to the reservation land in that sense. But there is one that is just solely a compact school, I believe. Is it?
To the chair, Jill Isaac, for the record, yeah. Chief Kitsap Academy is the one that does not engage with the BIA, and they have different facilities that are often on reservation and that the students go to because they have their fishery location that they do. It's a great campus. If you ever get to go to it, the kids get bused there for doing some of the science pieces. But by and large, the model, the students are on reservation, or the location is on reservation, and non-reservation students come to the reservation to be able to go to school. And similar teachers are able to go between the existing school district and be employed with certification and retirement systems at the school that's on the reservation by the tribe. So both the teachers and students can seamlessly flow if they migrate, as we know families do.
So the compact is with the state in Washington, or is the compact with the federal?
To the chair, the compact is a state tribal compact. And because of the status and the BIA engagement with the lower 48 tribes, they also receive and do separate reporting for BIA funds that are not considered the state tribal compact itself, except for Chief Kitsap, which is just with the state. So that's there's not a federal compact. It's a BIA process that's not compacting.
Okay. And then I want to point out, Washington has had robust tribal consultation since 2000, Millennium Project or whatever it was called. And so they have some really strong foundations for this kind of work that we have had fits and starts of trying to do here in Alaska, but we don't have things as in place as Washington in that area with 2022 just, you know, we finally recognize tribes. So the consultation piece that they've had for some time, we've we've started on it and we've scratched at it, but we don't have it in place really well. So, co-chair Story.
Ah, yes. Thank you, co-chair Himshut. Through the chair, I have a follow-up question to the compacts in state of Washington. Are they funded through their base student allocation and federal both, or is it just federal funding for some of the schools, or is it through the base student allocation?
Through the chair to Representative Story, they are funded. I don't know. I think Joel can speak to the actual funding formula that they use. I can speak to the fact that they are both funded by the federal government through BIE as well as through the state. And so when I was only able to Zoom meet with one group to kind of get an understanding of that complexity of managing those two pots of money and where you use things for all students versus tribal citizens, et cetera. They've seemed to have a pretty good grasp of how to do that and see success in being able to utilize both sources of funds.
Did you want to add something?
Yeah. Through the chair to Representative Story, Joel Isaac, for the record, they are using Washington State's public school funding appropriations process for to fund the schools. And then, as Misha said, the federal government does a completely separate funding mechanism through the BIA, through the BIE, so Indian Affairs, Indian Education, for those two. And they have a completely separate reporting and accountability system. So, for example, Chief Kitsap, it's the one that only does the state, not the Fed. And then they figure out how to pay for anything that the state's not covering. And then with the federal state funds, it's with Chief Lesh, I've been able to visit that school as well and talk with their school administrator. The tricky thing is they spend a tremendous amount of time doing federal reporting because those two systems don't speak to each other. And that's part of the issue that they experience is you're accepting federal money and you're spending a significant amount on it to just report back. Mm-hmm. And there's less red tape with the state of Washington than the Fed, and there's more funding coming from the state of Washington for their students than the federal government because BIE is so underfunded.
And I think when I looked, is one of the schools located in Bellingham?
I would have to the chair, Joel Isaac, for the record, I have to get back to you. I believe so, but my Washington map, I was looking at cities yesterday, and I'm a little bit mixed up in my mind.
Yeah, it just seems like I saw a similar curriculum to what we used in my elementary school where I taught, and when I looked at one of the schools, and this has been quite a while ago. So I would welcome help from you in reaching out to Washington to find experts in what they did and how they did it. Anytime that we don't have to completely recreate something, if we can learn from someone else, is a good opportunity. So any other questions before we go on? And anything that you want to add before I move us to the next section? Okay, I think we'll go on at slide 15. I'm going to get to hear the name pronounced correctly. Thank you.
You did good.
Thanks.
Okay, next one. Through the chair, Blalotek Wang Giminak Agviak. This is Giminak Maddie Agviak. Good morning, and thank you for having us. I'm from Nome, Alaska, and my mom's family is from King Island. And I'm representing my tribe, King Island Native Community. And we did this STEC application in partnership with the Village of Solomon. There's four tribes that reside in Nome, and King Island and Village of Solomon, we decided to go in on this STEC application together. And we currently don't have a school, but our mission for our tribal school is to revive and restore our Inuit language and culture for the strength of our people. So as it's been mentioned this morning, language revitalization is big with tribal schools, and especially for ours, our potential tribal school. We want to revitalize our Inupiaq language. And immersion schooling, it provides communities with a proven successful approach to language revitalization. And doing this work, language work, time is really crucial. Our youngest fluent speakers are 65 and older. And we just had at our annual meeting in December, we found out that we only have 20 speakers left in Nome that were first language speakers. And, you know, we're losing elders every year. So time is really crucial to revitalize our language. And two of our younger speakers are actually in this picture here. In this photo is my mom, Yayuk Alvan Stimple, and my cousin Marilyn Kazuna Ireland. I was a teacher for 9 years, teaching Head Start through second grade. And in 2020, I had the opportunity to be an Inupiaq immersion teacher at Nome Public Schools. And for 4 years, yeah, from 2020 to 2024, I was still learning Inupiaq. So my mom would come into the classroom with my cousin Marilyn. They are the two youngest fluent speakers in Nome. Or no, there's a couple others. But for the King Island community, they are the youngest fluent speakers. But they would come into the classroom and help me gain my fluency. I'm now an intermediate speaker, and I'm still becoming fluent. But they would come in every day and speak with the children. And in this picture here, we're actually making Mizraq. Mizraq is seal oil. Every spring, a lot of teachers like to plant flowers, but I never wanted to do that. Because in the springtime, we make seal oil. And so this year in particular was the first year I did get to make Mizraq in the spring with my students. And these were first graders, and this memory, it's stuck with them. You know, when they see me, they're in fifth grade now, and one girl, she said, "Miss Kiminuk, I remember when we made seal oil." So these activities, they stick with the kids. You know, they're like core memories of doing these activities that are subsistence activities that our people have done for thousands of years. After 2024, I did leave the elementary school, and I work now at Kawerik at our cultural center as the curator of educational programs. Even though I was extremely grateful to be an Inupiaq immersion teacher in our public school, there was just absolutely no support. There was no admin support. We didn't have a curriculum. I was literally getting everything ready to teach the students right before the kids would walk in the door. And we had no control over the teacher trainings that we would receive or professional development. I think the last year I was there, our school adopted bookworms, and I had to sit through the 2-day training for that. That was not relevant for me at all. So yeah, we had no control over what we wanted to teach our kids, and we had no training. So that's how we arrived here with this opportunity, with the chance to have our own tribal school. And go ahead to the next one. So for our goals for our tribal school, we want to start small and grow as we go approach. So we just want to start with one grade and then add on every year. And we're hoping that it could be a K-4 school. But yeah, we want to start small and grow as we grow. And our curriculum, it'll be embedded with traditional knowledge from our elders. And now is the time to learn from them before they all leave us. And our curriculum, of course, will be place-based learning. Our environment will shape our curriculum, creating hands-on cultural activities. And students will learn traditional ways of harvesting animals, which will foster food security and environmental stewardship. The pedagogical approach of our STEC school will be deeply rooted in our language, in our Inupiaq language. And that inherently reflects our Inupiaq worldview, and one that encompasses our relationship with each other and the natural world. And our lessons will draw directly from the land and sea, and which are resources upon which our people have relied on for survival for thousands of years. And the relationship we have with our environment is fundamental to our identity as Inupiaq people. By learning from the land, students will come to understand themselves through the language in ways that will uplift them to their highest potential. Our worldview, values, and knowledge systems will be the core of our curriculum, not just a subject for 30 minutes, which is, you know, currently the model now, and it's not working. So the STEC school will provide students with the ability to live in ways that align with who we truly are. And language revitalization, it is a growing field. I'm currently a graduate student right now at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. And attaining a master's in Indigenous language revitalization. And there's more and more research out there that shows a link between language revitalization and well-being. Studies show that there's a significant correlation between language revitalization efforts and improvement in Indigenous people's well-being. And, you know, that's why we're all here. We want our communities to be well. We want our students to live a good life. And that's why you're all here, too, as representatives and senators for Alaska. We deeply care about the health and well-being, and we're all here to serve Alaskans. And we know we all want what's best for our kids. And just this weekend, Sunday, we woke up to some sad news. There was actually a suicide of a young man in Nome, and you know, this happens far, far too often. Our current systems are continually failing our kids, and we know we desperately need change. It's time to provide our children with the opportunity to truly know who they are as Native people, which will foster well-being for our state. And, you know, that's why we're here. We want our kids to live, you know. So, yes, through this tech school, we plan to provide rigorous instruction in both Inupiaq and English, and we want to prepare our students for success in the world that we live in. And I'll just end with a quote too from a Mohawk speaker, Ryan Decaire. He stated that it is said that people revitalize a language, but really it's the language that revitalizes the people. And, you know, that's how I envision the outcome of our STEC school, to revitalize our people in a way our ancestors can clearly understand who we are today and we can understand them. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you. And I think I can speak for the committee in offering our condolences. When we lose somebody, especially in small communities like Nome, mm-hmm. the whole community carries that grief. So are there questions for this part? Representative Story, Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshoot. A comment and then a question. I think one thing I hope everyone realizes around the table, and else again, as my understanding is right about this, is as we go forward with this and when we look at the bill, we should all be aware that we're going to have to make an investment in our tribal compacting schools. It's funded through the BSA, but if I'm understanding it right, your school will be funded with a startup fee and then as if you have 120 students. And correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just looking at the prior fiscal notes. And the other schools have a certain amount of funding because they're growing and they're planning, and this is my understanding anyway. And so we are going to be, you know, having to make an investment when we will still have some of our students in the school that they're in now, and then they'll choose a different school, or they might choose the tribal compacting school. We don't know. But my question is, and again, I'm kind of using this as a hearing, but also to prep for a future kind of bill hearing so we know what to be looking mm-hmm. for. And that is, I know in Senate Bill 34, our State Board of Education and Early Development was to meet with all the different communities and then also to meet with the local education association. And I know they've done that, but it would be nice to have the reports of those meetings, just so we know the conversations, what they talked about. And then, as you know, we started the bill hearing last April, and we had the superintendent from Nome here who was very supportive of this school. But she also, you know, said at the same time they're trying to have their language immersion program in their school, and when they have a loss of enrollment, then they have to cut, and oftentimes, you know, unfortunately, you're cutting language because we don't have you have to have English, math, science mm-hmm. to graduate from high school. And so those are the kind of core programs they keep, and they're unfortunately cutting things that they know are really important to kids. And they had suggested like a hold harmless, and I think the superintendent from Ketchikan had also suggested some type of hold harmless mechanism as we go through, since we fund on student count, as we go through this transition in the communities that have the tribal programs. And I'm saying all this, it puts just to know that what would that look like if you had some ideas, if you're talking with the superintendents mm-hmm. in your areas, so they can have ideas to give to the board about what that would look like. So anyway, thank you for what you've shared about that. I just wanted to, you know, put out those thoughts because we want to have you having a dialogue how to make this a reality because we know it's so important. I don't know if you had any comments to that.
Yeah,
but
did you?
This is Giminak Akbiak, so thank you for that comment. And just wanted to make it add to that that, yeah, the Inupiaq Immersion Program at Nome Public Schools doesn't exist any longer. But that's, and it's because I'm not there, because I moved. But moving forward, what we can do is, you know, have a partnership between the tribal school and the public school and provide language services for the public school, whether that be through mini classes or, you know, going to their classrooms. But we could partner with the school district to provide those language classes, because right now there's none. There's none in existence right now because I'm not there.
Follow up? Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, and that was a conversation I hope can be happening right now with the current superintendent, what that would look like and a framework for that. I think that would help inform the committee. Thank you.
And then I guess my question about that is, my understanding is if you have a tribal compact public school, it's the whole shebang, but can it be that you have a compact, and again, the compact is with the state, not with the local district. So I was thinking if human resources were compacted or language immersion was compacted, bits and pieces rather than the whole thing. Is that an option?
To the chair, Joel Isaac, the mechanism for that, the way that the conversations with this specific bill language and in negotiations is that with the tribally compacted public school functioning as a school district, it doesn't require then an additional compact with a school district. It's just like a shared services agreement. Mm-hmm. And things like HR were discussed, building costs and transportation costs, those types of shared services, that some school districts currently do that anyway. And that's that's that model, and that's part of the important, like one of those pillars of this bill process, is that the tribes function as a school district to be able to engage as school districts do, so that it's not having to have a compact with the state and then a compact with the school district, because the school district's not a government. And so it becomes a form of contracting that's a little bit different than a compact, but it's the same way that school districts currently do. And that's established in Title 14 already, so we didn't amend that. Mm-hmm. It's currently permissible.
So if a tribe simply wanted to offer programming during the school day, say language classes, right now that's possible?
To the chair, if the school district were to pay the tribe for that, that mechanism exists as a way to do that. There are significant alignments that have to take place to make that happen, mm-hmm. and it typically does not happen because the shared vision is not connecting enough, mm-hmm. and often it has to do with it's the perception of English is the valued piece, and the school district needs to be the driver's seat, and there's not that willingness to work with the tribe as an equal. And then the state certification problem becomes the other issue. And speaking from personal experience, I run into that where I'm allowed to volunteer, but the school district can't have me be a teacher because I'm not an employee of the school district. And I could go much further into that, but that's essentially the issue of employment. And then how you do this, my tribe, not a compacting partner, has 7 MOUs with the school district, and many tribes do that process right now of MOUs, but it's limited because of that authority of not being a district.
So what I'm getting at, there are 229 tribes in our state. If a tribe wants to offer one piece but is not ready to do, can't do the whole thing, then they would say, we're not going to try to operate a TCPS. We are going to offer this bit that we are currently offering, that we're able to offer. In that case, the tribe would not participate. Okay.
To the chair, yes.
Okay.
The tribe could just do like a contract or an MOU with the school district if they were not ready to go full board and operate an entire classroom.
Right.
And that's the health service model versus the compacting model. When we talk about the compacts, it's like for an entire grade band. versus just teaching math or just, and I say just as a single class, mm-hmm. It would, or a single subject, the compact are operating at minimum an entire grade level is the threshold for compacting.
So a tribe could compact with the state and offer fourth grade.
If there is authorization from the legislature to allow for a tribe to receive public school funding through the BSA Foundation formula, yes. That piece of letting the public dollars flow, D does not have the authority as an appropriator to direct public funds to whatever entity it chooses. Obviously, for protective purposes, that's the deed. The department can't just be like, oh, we're funding this school, and not this one. It's through the foundation formula.
Right. Okay.
And that's that district piece that's part of the bill.
I guess I'm just trying to get at the root of this. If you're going to be a tribe with a compacted school, you're going to offer the whole school. But that is not what I thought I heard you say, which was a single grade level.
To the chair, that single grade level is like the threshold for a school. You're seeing in the proposals that it's these applicants are doing multiple grade bands. Mm-hmm. And that's the legal permissible answer versus what's practically being done is multiple grades. And so it looks more like you would typically see for a school being like a K-3 or a K-6. But that threshold, that minimum threshold is a full course, not just one part of education.
Okay. All right. Representative Quintero Story.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, my question has to be, not, you don't have to share that this time, but I know that you picked 120 BSA, thinking you'll have 120 students, and I know you said you were starting smaller, mm-hmm. So it'd be helpful to know how you picked that number. You don't have to share it now, but just as we go along. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'd be curious for all the projects, the tribal compacting schools, how the number was picked and the vision for that. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, we made it to slide 17, folks. 17 of 41. It's good conversation, though. I'm really glad that you guys are here and that we're having this time.
And to the chair on the number of slides, there are more information slides at the end that were there as rather than trying to do multiple handouts. So just as far as some of those at the end are for informational purposes.
Okay, great. Welcome back, Representative Underwood.
Well, good morning. My name is Carl Chambly. I'm the campus director for Kinnick Tribe, the Michael Tucker Learning Campus, not the executive director. And I'll just give you a little bit of background. So I grew up in Alaska. I graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I was a teacher and a principal in Kotzebue for 18 years. I finished up my education career as a federal programs director for Mat-Su Borough School District. That was about 7 or 8 years ago. I don't remember exactly. And then I took on a job with Kinnick Tribe to help develop their education agency, their code of ordinances, and also start the Kinnick Charter School. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So our mission, and this is worked on with quite a few people in the community. We had over 40 Zoom meetings and in-person meetings with over 350 people in the Wasilla community. And it was real important to the community to have a world-class education that also includes academics and culture and eventually language. Language is hopefully our partnership with Kenai-T will work out and we can get some Dena'ina language going in the Kinnick area. But it's primarily about finding success for students in their future endeavors, and that's our mission. And so whatever we need to do that. Go ahead and I'll go through this. So our school goals, and just so you know, we started the school 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, we had 80 students, and currently we have 250 students in grades K through 12. We have waiting lists. We have to do a lottery system in order to fill up some of our classrooms currently. So we have quite a bit of growth over the last 4 years. Our school is in 20 portable units. It's located on property that's owned by the tribe. Next door to the school, we also operate a STEAM Academy, which is supplemental education services for grades 6 through 12. It's funded through the federal government A&E program primarily. So we receive grants to do that. We teach construction. We teach drones and robotics, computer programming, computer build programs. We do 3D printing, CNC machines. We offer high school credit through an MOA with the Matsuburo School District. We're open year-round. We serve students over the summer. We offered over 100 students the opportunity to receive high school credit just in two summer sessions this last year. So we've been very active, and it's a very popular place for young people. Also, our goals were to build a strong community, instill indigenous knowledge and values. All of our federal grants, as well as our school, our goal is to include culture, indigenous culture, local culture, and Alaska-wide Native culture into our programming, including math, science, reading, and, of course, STEAM. Yeah. So that's kind of an old slide, but that's kind of our mix from last year. This year, you can add about 50 students to that. Currently, we're in year four operating this school. You can see some of the activities the students are doing. The other thing I would add is the school is open to everybody. It's a public charter school. We have a 10-year contract with the Matsuburo School District. And so we've been operating the school with a team of teachers and a principal from the Matsuburo School District, hired through the Matsuburo School District. And they are governed by the APC as other charter schools. And we'll talk a little bit about that, the bylaws and how those bylaws were written and the governance structure.
Are you operating your own correspondence program or are they correspondence through the MATSU program?
Thank you for that question. And when we did our application with the Matsuburo School District, we included a K-12 brick and mortar school and also a K-12 charter correspondence school in that single application. So we are offering both through the Kinnick Charter School. So we have students that are blended. Some students are full-time homeschool, and some students are full-time brick and mortar. The full-time homeschool students also have access to all of our STEAM programs that's in the building next to the school, and we offer free and reduced lunch. We do offer some busing. Our school is about 65% Alaska Native American Indian and 35% non-Alaska Native American Indian. Also, we're about 90% free and reduced lunch.
And you said that some of your funding came from A&E, which is federal. And often federal funds are, here you go, try it out, and then you have to figure out how to make it work. When those funds stop, usually it's like 2-3 year grant cycles.
Yes, Chair Hemshoot. So we operate, currently we're operating 7 different grants within that. 4 of them are sunsetting at the end of this year, which employ about 14 individuals. So those 4 grants are very specifically written as to what they'll provide. One is a construction grant, one is an aviation drone grant, one is a subsistence grant, so food, security, subsistence. We do hunter safety with that grant. We do a lot of outdoor activities with the students with that grant. So those grants are sunsetting, and there are very specific goals with those grants. Each one, I think, has 17 objectives, and those are through the A&E program. We do have 3 grants that will carry some of our programs forward, but that, like you said, that funding, those are originally 3-year grants. We made the money last. We asked for no cost extensions for an additional year. We were able to carry on all those activities for an additional year, but this will be the end for those 4 grants.
So So then you'll be operating off state funds and then the three remaining grants.
Correct. Okay. So we're operating really dual programs. So two programs separated by 150 feet. So the school operates off of the state BSA through the charter school. And then those students are shared with the STEAM Academy. The STEAM Academy itself is funded through those federal grants. So the money only really mixes when the kids walk across the street or the kids come in from home. We provide those services.
And what happens to the STEAM Academy? It's one of those three grants that are continuing?
Well, the STEAM Academy will continue operations. It will have to scale down the amount of offerings that it's having. That's something that, you know, I've spent some time going down to Washington, D.C. recently, and we're looking at alternatives to losing our funding or replacing the funding. There are other grant opportunities. We're constantly looking at grant opportunities. It's a full-time job just looking for grants and writing grants and and then reporting on grants and tracking the finances of grants. So
evaluating the grant.
Yes. So, but it's worth it because we can provide some real high quality programs for our students.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
I apologize. Co-chair Story.
Thank you. Through co-chair Himshut, a similar question I asked before is, this the conversations you've had state board with your school, also with the current superintendent. Since you are a charter school, I believe the district would only be having 0.4% for administration overhead or helping, so it's not as big of a enrollment adjustment as maybe other districts would be. But I'd be curious your conversations with your local school board as well as the state board. Not at this time, if I'm not, but I was just saying future preparation would be good to come with that.
Well, I think, you know, I can talk about just briefly. Our application was something that we worked on with our community, and what we put in that application, the things that were important to us for the charter school. We rolled that application through our tribal council, the bylaws for how we would operate. I kept them up to speed the entire way. They approved it. I asked for their approval, the tribal council approval first. They were the ones initiating this process to open a charter school, so they got first look at everything. Once it went through them, then it went to the school board, and the school board heard it. We had a couple different meetings. We had parents and students show up and testify about how this was important to them, and the school board thankfully approved it as well. And then it went to the state school board, and that was a similar question and answer session, and we described what we wanted to do, and we were approved in June, and we opened our doors in August. Yeah.
Wow.
So I hired a principal between June and August, and we found a temporary facility until our facility could be opened in January that year.
Okay. All right, let's continue.
I don't recommend that timeline. I'm about 10 years older over the course of 4 years. So this is kind of the work that we did prior to opening the charter school. So this path to education compacting also lends itself well to education compacting. But the Connect Tribe Constitution, which goes back a long ways, and then established a tribal council. And you can see there that kind of what the duties and roles are of the tribal council. Part of my first job, my first year there, was to write a tribal education code and have that adopted by the tribal council. And that was adopted by the tribal council. Within the tribal education code, we set up a tribal education committee and a tribal education department for policy and day-to-day operations and just running all our education decisions through those two. And so those recommendations from the Tribal Education Committee then go to the Tribal Council for approval. That established a Connect Tribe as a tribal education agency under federal law. So this is going back 6 years, and that made us eligible for some of those federal grants and set us up for being able to administrate those grants. So as far as a state tribal education compacting, when that opportunity opened up, I was aware of it going back to Alaska's education challenge. In those days, I was an administrator, and I was following, and I was participating in those things. And so I was aware of the opportunity coming down the pike that there would be compacting. And actually, when we opened up our charter school, that was one of our goals, so that we could establish the school in such a way that the transition to compacting would be easier and more seamless for us. So this was something that we had in mind when we established the charter school. And so so that opportunity came about. I applied for the funding to help pay our attorneys and myself to, as lead negotiator for Connect Tribe, to sit in those meetings for a year and work on this, going through Title 14, going through all the details, and adding my experience as being a teacher and a principal, and then working for the tribe to the conversation. And so that's kind of the long and short of it. I'm happy to answer any questions and invite you all for a tour at any time. I know a representative Underwood has been there and helped us with our first graduation. So thank you.
The only question I have, and I do want us to keep moving because we have to finish at about 5 to 10. So my question is, when you say you opened it in a way that would make it seamless to transition into becoming a TCPS, what kinds of things are different about your school than a different charter school?
Well, there's many things, but what I'm kind of proud of is that, you know, there are no barriers for anybody to attend our school. That, I don't think that can be said for all charter schools. We have free and reduced lunch. Of course, there's the culture piece. Of course, there's the subsistence activities, the outdoor rec, all the things that we do from the tribe that I described earlier. Those things don't exist in most charter schools. Where you have the tribe as a very, very, very strong partner, mm-hmm. providing anything at all that the school could want. The science teacher wanted to do a environmental study on Cottonwood Creek. So we did a partnership where we provided the vans, we provided chaperones, we picked the kids up, we drove them to the creek, we created a video and app for them to summarize their project and submit it on a national scale. So we have that sort of partnership that happens almost daily, where we can take kids on field trips. We have to sign them out from the school, sign them into the tribe, so the liability piece, and then we can take them and chaperone them with the vans. So there's a lot of things that make us different, but those are the things I'm most proud of, is the fact that the tribe can lend all of its expertise and resources to make that school much more than it would be if it was just the BSA and just those 20 portables.
And the busing, is that provided by the tribe?
The busing is provided by the school district through the transportation grant that the school district provides. So the school district is able to provide three buses, I believe, two for sure, one that goes east and picks up kids at a satellite location, and then one that goes west and picks up students. So we have students that arrive from all over the valley.
Is there busing for other charter schools?
It is offered for other charter schools as well.
Like existing routes pick up kids and drop them in different places, or you know, is it a separate system?
No, it's basically we're using the same bus transportation system that the other charter schools are already using, like Academy Charter School and some of the others. So it's buses provided by the bus contractor, and then the director of transportation establishes the routes.
So the neighborhood schools have a bus system, and the charter schools have a bus system.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's operated very similarly by the same contractor and through the same Department of Transportation at the Matsubara School District.
Okay, but it's not, as far as you know, it's not, there's one route and it serves all the schools, whether they're a neighborhood school or a charter school.
How they do their routings, I'm not real clear on, but I think we have two buses that are dedicated to us for morning drop-off and afternoon pickup, and I think that's the same with the others as well.
All right. Thanks. Other questions? Co-Chair Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshut. I was going to suggest that if we have other questions, we could just share them later and get them out to the districts, and then we could move on to our other guests that are here.
Okay.
Because I do have some other questions, but
well, thank you so much.
Time is short. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Yeah. Ulalotak Uvanga Mark Roseberry and Nupiak Sinan is Oyagak. Anyway, through the chairs, co-chairs, thank you for inviting us today. And I am the education director for the Nupiak community of the Arctic Slope and the administrator for Korea Academy Tribal School. So I wanted to, one of the things, and I believe, you know, some of you may have heard of these things before, but I know there's always a lot of questions on the legality and why tribes have the rights. And I'll briefly just go through with the ICAST Council. About 4 years ago, the ICAST Council decided to exercise what's in, you know, there's a question about the Constitution. In the ICAST Constitution, education is one of those services that the council is a part of the tribe for us to present. And yes, the RICAS constitution was signed off by the Department of Interior and the Secretary of Interior when they developed in 1971, I believe. So anyway, ICAS is a sovereign Indian tribe, and we are one of the two regional tribes in the state. Tlingit Haida is the other one. And so we our land base is jurisdictional area anyway is around 97,000 square miles, so it's a little bit bigger than the North Slope Borough. Anyway, the ICAST Council decided that it was time. They received funds, as many groups did with COVID, and used those discretionary funds to develop the education department. So as part of that, when we had that, and in 2021, in July 2021, we established the education department that was established initially by a resolution, and then we codified it with an ordinance. And within that ordinance defines how ICAS will exercise education. Within there is the development of an education committee, which oversees education and is advisory to the ICAST Council, but also is the governing body of Korgi Academy Tribal School. And so there are bylaws that are associated with the Education Committee. So that's how we started legally. So if we can go on to the next slide. So Korgi Academy now is a tribal school, but I'm going to go to the next slide and how we began. So, you know, up in the North Slope, there's always been this desire, grassroots desire of what can we do differently. The people for decades and decades and decades have been wanting the language, culture, and all of those things in the school. And I know the local school district has tried over and over, but when you are bringing in administrators and teachers that are not a part of the communities, they don't just automatically absorb and know what to do with the culture, language, or anything else. And so when you have high turnover rates of every 2 years is usually the average, and lack of longevity, it's very difficult to have consistency. So the local people, elders, they had how many different education summits and talking about it, and it always comes out with the same thing. This is what we want. But we're not quite getting there. So, you know, before Korgi Academy started, we were looking at different options. And this is grassroots looking at. Some of the leaders up there were talking with me about it. You know, do we do a private school? What do we do? It's very difficult to fund a private school. And so one of the options was a charter school. And so we started that, and we developed we made an application, and the charter school was approved by the local school board and approved by the state school board. And, you know, we did that relatively quickly as well. Within a year, we had all of that done. And in 2021, the charter school was started. However, some members of the school board changed out, and the new members did not want a charter school. And so they started dismantling it from within a month. And so that's when the Academic Policy Committee came to the tribe and said, hey, we still want this to go. We're not able to come to terms with the district. And so it became a tribal school, and we established it. Now, they don't just transfer because it's government. See, they closed down the charter school. It wasn't a transfer, and it's not a commodity. In the same way, our tribal school is owned, you know, fully under the tribe. And so they used we used discretionary funds to start that, hire teachers, and then we started with within that same year and have continued for the last 4 years. The challenge for us and what makes Carnegie Academy so different is, and that's the process we use to get there, what makes it different is the focus that we have. So you see the conventional schools follow a model that really came from the late 1800s and early 1900s, and it's based on efficiency and based on the Industrial Revolution, and everything that's done was done, you know, this is when the first time people were paying taxes and everything, and it was designed for efficiency. People didn't want to pay high taxes, and, you know, they wanted to get them ready for the Industrial Revolution. So everybody, you know, they treated students like commodities, and you start here, and you're going to do this, and here are your standards for doing this, 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 and this, except human beings aren't a commodity, and everybody's different. And so in Carnegie Academy, the tribe recognizes this, and so our school model follows research, actually. And if you look at Montessori research, and there's other schools like Waldorf, and there's tons of resources that support what Montessori did and how human beings learn. And so we're taking that research, and we started designing a school that follows that and training the schools that follow in that framework. So if I can go to the next slide, because I know I don't know if I'm going to.
I'm going to ask that we, if you don't mind, if
no, we can go on. Yeah.
I apologize.
So one of the things you're going to see, the environment in Carnegie Academy is very different. And because of that, and because our structure is very different, we don't have a 6-period day or 7-period day. We have blocks of time that we work, and we're able to monitor the students. And I know I don't have a lot of time to go through some of these things, but a big part of it is we realize that we can't just put our teachers through a prep program that teaches them in the traditional, you know, conventional way, and then expect them to come back and teach in the way that we need them. So we're creating our own apprenticeship, and we started that with APU. We finished the first course this last fall, and the APU is really on board. They already had an apprenticeship, and we were looking at, well, what courses can we design and fit in there? And there's some things that our teachers are just going to take that are the basics, but it works, and we're going to be able to get what we wanted for Carnegie Academy, and the teachers are going to be able to get a bachelor's degree and actually get a tribal certification. And with the way that the legislation is written, then we would share, you know, give that certification to DEED, who could review it, and then issue a state certification. So we're already starting that process. We also have a appropriation request, and as you know, our federal government gets their act together, if they pass it, then we'll have an appropriation this summer that will also help us enhance the teacher apprenticeship. But it takes a lot of work and fundraising for us to maintain the tribal school, because there, as you've seen, there's not just all this funding out there. And so, you know, a large portion of my time is spending fundraising and advocating and doing those things. Anyway, you know, we have a whole child, and we really operate in the whole child. So you're not going to see, oh, you know, language and culture is inherent because we hire local educators. But we also have, how are we going to keep the academics? We have virtual contracted educators that fulfill those highly qualified areas to help our students along. And next, and then, I mean, these are just some pictures. We did have graduates. You can see that the environment's differently. But what I really want to show you in these pictures is what the students are doing. Yes, they're doing the academics, but these are the things that really inspire them and help them become who they are and build their cultural identity. And, you know, when I was sharing this with people, we had a tribal summit bringing all of the village tribes in. And when they saw these pictures, I can't tell you how many people had tears in their eyes, because they grew up not having in school they were disciplined, my wife being one of them. You speak the language, you were disciplined. You don't do any of the cultural things, or you were disciplined. That had a long-term effect on the people up there. And when they were seeing these pictures and what we're doing in our school, it just brought so many tears, and it brought a emotional reaction to, we really need this to happen. And that cannot be duplicated in the current systems. That's why tribal compacting is so important. Anyway, questions?
Any questions? Coach, your story.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for being here. Just wondering, what virtual programs are you working with, and do they have more indigenous content?
So on the academic side, what we really wanted to do is separate out the indigenous content. Not that it all has to be, because you could have projects that incorporate it. But our students, we realize that our students need to understand how to operate in the Western world. When you go take tests, or you're going to college, or you're getting certifications, they don't adjust those tests, and our students need to understand the language. So we're really focusing on, we actually like having the Western academics, and our teachers can incorporate. So say we have an activity or project, we place-base it. And then we're bringing, so because we have local educators in, it's inherent in our day-to-day operations throughout the day. I don't have to have a special class or a special curriculum to figure out how to incorporate the culture, because it's done automatically by the instructors that are there in the classroom, because that's what they know. And if that makes sense, because one of the things, when I saw curriculum that you put the cultural elements in, if you have somebody teaching it that aren't of the culture, they're not teaching it. And I observe that in our own school district. They're really not teaching it. It could be in there, but they don't know how to really incorporate it. And when they do, it is really shallow. So anybody that's been in the culture a long time will say, okay, they're just touching it. So they're touching maybe what the animal is and the different parts of an animal, and they'll use a local animal. But that doesn't tie to the deep connection that the Inupiaq people have with that animal.
I'm going to interrupt here for just a second. Yeah. Not that what you're saying isn't important, but I think the question was, what are the virtual programs that you're using?
Yeah, we're using Edmentum and Ed Options Academy.
Through the chair. And who is that with?
Edmentum. Edmentum and Ed Options Academy is through Edmentum.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. Through the chair, not familiar.
Edmentum is we can look it up probably online.
Through the chairs, we can email you the spelling and the name, if that would be helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think I had it on a previous slide here too, but yeah.
Thank you. And I do need us to move on.
Yeah.
One last question to Mr. Roseberry. Is your background in education before you came to this work?
Yes.
For you?
I was a teacher and administrator, career and technical administrator, assistant superintendent,
And then what is your home school district?
North Subborough School District.
So I was a science educator, and they are known across the state for their work in cultural standards through science. Yeah. So
and they have
really
those,
impressive work.
Yeah, it is. And it's very impressive. What happens is, and when I've worked in the schools, teachers coming in get stressed out because they said, we're not from here. I've had teachers with tears in their eyes. Not that the work itself is impressive. It is awesome. Yeah. But when you have educators not familiar coming into a new place on a regular basis, it is stressful on them. And that's what our point is. It's very stressful on them. And there's like, we're expected to teach something that we don't know. And I can't tell you how many have been brought to tears.
High quality place-based education requires knowing the place.
Yes.
Yeah, it takes time to get there. Okay. Could we, I'm sorry to rush, we have 5 minutes, and then we're going to cut it off at 9:59.
Okay. It's okay. Mine's pretty fast. So I'm glad that the slides at the front are these. I was going to put them at the end, but this was last, as you can see, 23, and then 25, 24, 25. So this was last school year. And these are the scores of our students that were in tribal schools tribal scholars last year. A lot of them are still in this year, except for the ones who have graduated. And you can see the test date when we initially did our testing, our MAP testing, and other testing that we do. And I would have to look it up because right now my brain's not working. So, but as you can see, we have kids in the 12th grade who were reading and math. This was their math was at a fourth grade level. And within that, just over a year, their college level math. And we have about 4 of our students on here that were urgent intervention. We had 2 that were, we got to do intervention and on watch. We only had a few that were at level or above. And as you look at the second test we did in March, most of our students tested on or above their grade level. And that's math. Our next slide is reading, which is very similar in the sense that we were able to see even greater jumps in our reading scores. And one of the things, if you can go on to the next slide, since you guys have access to that, one of the things that we do in our Tribal Scholars Program, which is started with an A&E grant in partnership with the Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District. We still work in partnership with the school district. We utilize teachers that are district teachers. And we have been able to take our kids places. We do place-based learning. All of our kids are going to the University of Alaska Southeast for biology. We have a great teacher. We have a fantastic teacher that is with our kids right now. We've been very fortunate to have amazing teachers all the way through for the last few years, so 13 to over 10 years.
Scott, I'm going to interrupt for a second. I see some dignitaries there, including Bob Sam.
Oh, yes.
But could you put your name on the record also?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Sonia Scan for the record. So sorry. So I think we have one more. So this is something that we love to do and we've tried to incorporate always, and that is getting out and being on the land and going through and looking at historical sites, looking at we were able to have one of our local tribal members come in and teach our children how to put together a skate. We were one of the only schools in the state, and I think even further, that got an educational permit from NOAA for halibut. And so we take our kids out and teach them how to get halibut. We obviously shrimp, salmon. They had a salmon omelet with greens, and oh, it just looks delicious. And our students, they were able to then take this food and give it to our elders. They were also able to take it home and cook for their parents. One of the things that we know is a lot of our kids don't have driver's license. And I don't know if that's all over the state, but I certainly know in Ketchikan that is a big deal. And so that's one of the things, is getting the kids to the DMV to get their permit and getting them ready to go. So in short, I know I'm out of time. I just would love for you to look at what we do. I know there's some reading here. If you have any questions, my name and number are on here. I love what we do as a school. I love Tribal Scholars and where it's come. And we want to grow what we're doing. And compacting is how it's going to happen. So thank you for your time. It's much appreciated.
I apologize for running out of time.
No,
it's been a good conversation
fine.
Today.
Thank you so
Did
much.
Did you have anything to add, Dr. Isaac?
Just for the record, Joel Isaac, we really appreciate the chance to model the tribal voice leading, kicking off this session and presenting this. So thank you both to both co-chairs. And again, we appreciate you for coming last night for the Compacting Summit and for spending the time with us today.
Thank you so much for your time. We are going to have to wrap up. I do want to also put on record, we said on Monday that the department was unable to come. There was a miscommunication about whether or not they were invited. And so I just want to make sure that's really clear that there was, at no point did they decline to come. They couldn't come on that day. It was miscommunicated. And so we do have questions pending with them on the CLSD grant, and we'll get those answers to you soon. So we're going to conclude our meeting. Our next meeting is this Friday, January 30th, 2026 at 8 a.m. And that meeting will be focused on national and state perspectives on assessments. We'll have testimony from Dr. Martin West on the governing board of the NAEP, Superintendent of the Matsuburo School District, Dr. Randy Traney, Superintendent of Kodiak Islands Borough School District. And on the committee announcement, we misspelled it, but it is Cindy Mika, Dr. Mika. And then the Department of Education and Early Development will be here with us. So with no further business before the committee this morning, we are going to adjourn at 10:01.